Our next speaker is Dr. James Vrsaljevic, coming to us from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Dr. Vrsaljevic earned an MD PhD from Baylor and currently holds the title there of Professor of Pathology in the Department of Molecular and Human Genetics. His research interests include the human metagenome, the microbiome, and how microbial communities impact health, human health, and disease. His laboratory is deeply engaged in the development of new strategies to characterize the composition and dynamics of the human microbiome, and is currently working to characterize the intestinal microbiome and the nature of the core microbiome in healthy children. Dr. Vrsaljevic.
Well, thank you, Jeff, and this is my first time to this meeting, so I want to thank all of the organizers for the opportunity to contribute to this session. And so I guess I'll be following up on some of the points that Dr. Klanhammer's already made, but try to maybe emphasize some different angles with respect to probiotics, and to also emphasize the context in which this is working. The host, whether it's an animal, it's non-human or the human, but additionally the microbiome as we move forward. So we're doing our work in Houston, and I like to acknowledge our team at the beginning. Certainly they are playing a big role not only in doing the experiments, but in many of the ideas that I'll be describing in this talk. So I like to present these two figures because they really do, I think, symbolize the creative tension in microbiology, especially in the past decade or two, as the field of probiotics has really taken off, which is how do we approach microbes in medicine, whether that's veterinary medicine or human medicine? Are we going to just kill the microbe with antibiotics? Are we going to feed microbes and really focus on beneficial organisms? And then is there a combination approach? And increasingly now in medicine, and certainly my angle comes from human medicine being a physician, there certainly is more and more discussion about combination approaches as well. Certainly both will have a role as we go forward, and we'll just have to think carefully about when to apply each one, and of course the devil's in the details. So we have a definition of probiotics that I'm sure Dr. Sanders will also elaborate on, and not to spend too much time on this, but just to focus on the living viability piece, that probiotics are certainly considered to be live microorganisms that have some benefit to the host, and as you'll see in this talk, there are a variety of potential benefits. Now, as we delve into this, it's very important to keep in mind the microbiome, and I put human here, but obviously in the context of this meeting, maybe animal microbiome would be more appropriate, because clearly all animals have a microbiome, and whether we're talking about the gut or the skin or a variety of body surfaces, the reality is that we have complex microbial communities that we're just beginning to understand. And in fact, if you're very interested, there's a neat article that just came out in the New York Times today interviewing George Weinstock, Jeff Gordon, and a number of others, a feature article in the New York Times on microbes. They defend and define us. So a number of articles have certainly come out in the scientific literature as well related to the microbiome initiative, which we now have an international human microbiome consortium as well. And I, again, just bring this up because I think it's important to highlight the fact that this community, or I should say assemblage of organisms, complex community, this microbiome, strictly speaking, refers to a collection of genes. And we're discussing concepts in the community now. Is there a core microbiome? And again, we could think about any animal species. What is that core? That core seems to be very dependent on body site. One thing that's become very apparent in the past 5 years is the nature of the core and the entire microbiome is entirely dependent on the body habitat, whether we're talking about the gut versus the skin, very different. Vaginal microbiome that we're looking at now in the oral versus the colonic microbiome. So these are key points, but also the particular population, and we're seeing some major differences depending on ethnicity, geographic location, other habits, certainly dietary habits will be impacting that, and this certainly will have some important lessons for us in terms of the animal industry too. Now, there's clearly, seems to be a core, although I'll caution you and say that right now it appears that this core is going to be relatively small. But let's say about 800 to 1,000 species in the gut. We may be talking about 10 to 20 members that are really part of the core that most of us would carry. So it's a very small number. What we see is a much larger blue cloud. This is a figure from the review by Turnbull et al. Jeff Gordon was also one of the core authors of this, in addition to Claire Frazier. Clearly, there's this large variable piece, and we think that probiotics are going to have a particularly important effect here on changing that variable microbiome and the genes, the functions that are part of that, because clearly we want to get beyond catalogs of microorganisms. We all want to get into functional metagenomics, and what does all of this mean in the aggregate in terms of animal health and disease? And so as we're beginning to explore that further in our own, in my own laboratory, we've been very active within this microbiome initiative, although we've learned most of our lessons, I think, in the past 6 months in terms of the informatics component. There's so much data analysis now going on, and it takes us about a week to generate the data and 6 months to analyze it. And each of these dots now contains about 15,000 454 DNA reads. So, boy, talk about just putting a lot of work right into a small, what appears to be a single data point. But each of these is basically a distal gut microbiome from a different child with recurrent abdominal pain. Or in this case, these are healthy kids. We're also comparing these microbiomes with kids that have recurrent abdominal pain. But notice the adults are quite different. And actually, this is a three-dimensional principal components analysis. Clearly, the adults are segregating from the kids. These are kids 7 to 12 years of age, elementary school age versus young adults, mostly 20-something. So we're not talking about huge differences in terms of age. But clearly in the time dimension is also saying something about the microbiome. Now, why do I get into this here? Because the context, again, is very important. When in an animal's life do we administer particular probiotics or we try to how we manipulate that microbiome will really depend on when we administer that early in life versus later in life in terms of an adult. The sequencing data is certainly also helping us in terms of understanding our animal models, and we use the mouse in our group, and so I'm showing some of our unpublished data. And the point here is that when we add a probiotic, one particular Lactobacillus reuteri strain, this is the untreated mouse, when we add the Lactobacillus reuteri strain, what you see is obviously a lot of Lactobacillus in light blue, but we see now basically a blooming or proliferation of the Parabacteroides, which we don't see in the untreated mice, and we see now also greater species diversity. What's also becoming apparent is that one particular strain is having very predictable changes on the microbiome, and that a different strain of the same species, Lactobacillus reuteri, when administered to the mouse, will, it seems to be destabilizing that microbiome, leading to changes that we just can't quite predict over time. And so we're getting into some really interesting issues, because the key point here is that the administration of that probiotic adds in terms of that particular organism, but it also has quite a significant effect on its neighbors, the other microbial species, some of which are very different, and they may be suppressed. They may also be enhanced in terms of function depending on the particular probiotic strain. We're just beginning to understand the nature of this. And clearly, antibiotics are having a major effect. Others like Dave Relman are shedding light. Now, to just keep this moving, I'm just going to just amplify the points Dr. Klanhammer made. Clearly, we have autochthonous organisms and allochthonous organisms, indigenous versus transient. There are a number of Lactobacillus species, and there are others, to be fair, that aren't on this slide. Our model organism has been Lactobacillus reuteri. Clearly, there are other Lactobacilli, as you've already seen, Lactobacillus acidophilus, a number of different Lactobacillus species that have been studied in detail that may be conferring beneficial effects. But I'll focus for a moment on this species and try to address some basic questions. Can we use indigenous microbes or probiotics more specifically to replenish missing elements or functions? And that really is one certainly key goal here in this field. We're beginning to identify differences in medicine in terms of the human microbe, and now we can think in the case of Crohn's disease, maybe we add a Faecalibacterium. We never considered that as a probiotic before, but now we're beginning to think more broadly about probiotics and leaving just Lactobacillus and Bifidobacterium. Can we expand that world of probiotics, if you will? clearly there are a number of benefits that have been documented in the literature. In the interest of time, I just can't cite the various papers, but I think, again, in the prior lecture, you saw plenty of good examples, and I'm just going to mention briefly, we're going to get back to intestinal epithelial cell effects, effects on development, effects on certainly mucin production, and effects on basic physiology such as intestinal permeability. And we also have clearly profound effects on the immune system. Probiotics and beneficial microbes more broadly can suppress the immune system in terms of inflammation. They can also enhance immunity depending on the strain, again, or combinations of strains. Now, in this slide, this was a figure developed by Carissa Thomas, an MD-PhD student in my group, and just recently published in Gut Microbes. What Carissa summarized are just various effects by intestinal bacteria, including probiotics, on intestinal physiology and intestinal immunity. But I'll focus on just a few points here. I'm going to show some examples now of effects on cell signaling in macrophages or dendritic cells, cells of the myeloid lineage, and how these organisms may be having profound effects on a function of arms or components of the innate immune system. This may be very important, of course, in terms of defense against infection and just overall health status. And then we're going to also look at some data that show the effects of these organisms on the lymphocytes and the ability to produce antibody. And then finally, the intestinal epithelial cells and their ability to proliferate and migrate and develop. And certainly we'll be seeing then some various effects. So Chandra Iyer was a postdoctoral fellow in my group who was very interested in effects of probiotics on immune signaling pathways, some older data that we've already published, just to highlight some key points. And that is that we know that certain cytokines produced in humans and animals can signal through particular signaling pathways. This is TNF through the TNF receptor. This is pro-inflammatory and certainly part of the defense mechanism against pathogens. There are a number of signals then. This goes through an NF-kappa B pathway, not to belabor all of the molecular details. But what we see is that these organisms, in this case Lactobacillus reuteri is a probiotic model, strain, produce secreted factors that then block these signaling pathways at specific points. In this case, they block the ubiquitination shown here of the inhibitor I-kappa B alpha. And the net effect is a suppression of inflammation and basically a block in TNF production. So when we combine this with additional data, we could see that these probiotics could affect signaling by human or animal cytokines, part of the immune response, but they could also suppress signals from pathogens. For example, lipopolysaccharide or lipotychoic acid. You just heard about lipotychoic acid. These can also be present on pathogens that may be gram-positive, and so the probiotic may also suppress signaling, in this case at a different point, and therefore block the production of cytokines, block inflammation at different points in the signaling pathway because there are different signals, but the net result is the same, and that is a block in TNF production. So we're beginning to understand the effects on these signaling pathways, and there's Carissa. I just mentioned her figure. She's also been doing work in signaling in human cells. We're also studying mouse cells in the laboratory. And what Carissa has identified is a common node now, that a particular Lactobacillus reuteri strain, let's just think about any probiotic X, if you will, this bacterium is producing secreted factors, and somehow, we still don't know what's going on at the cell surface, and these are macrophages, myeloid cells more broadly, part of the innate immune system, they're somehow blocking signaling by suppressing TAP1. TAP1 is a common link between multiple signaling pathways, including MAP kinases and NF-kappa B, that I just described. And so now we're basically working our way from the cytokine, the protein being produced ultimately by these immune cells, up the pathway to a common node closer to the cell surface. And we think this may be now a critical signaling pathway. And if we want to choose a probiotic to suppress inflammation, then this would be one we could pick. And then we can also knock out a particular gene, as Todd has shown. We can do some genetics in this organism and knock out a fosfolipoglutamate synthase, and then basically not only eliminate the effect on TNF, but we see complete ablation of the effect on the signaling pathway. So Carissa's done a lot of work kind of probing the literature and then came up with some figures to summarize this at the request of Gail Hecht, who's the editor-in-chief of Gut Microbes, to try and put this into some kind of order. So within myeloid cells, she's put together literature. We don't have individual strains here, but with different lactobacillus species, different probiotics, if you will, including bifidobacterium, here you see Adolescentis, and Saccharomyces boulardii, a yeast probiotic, you can see that there are a number of effects on different steps, different signaling pathways within cells that have been described, either a block or a stimulation depicted by the arrow. And there you see lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. So we're now beginning to sort of put it all together. And so in the future, this is still daunting, but in the future, we could choose a particular probiotic for a given application. And in an animal, that may administering it early in life to prevent inflammation, maybe to enhance immunity and to prevent infection. And so we see the same thing in intestinal epithelial cells. There are these common critical signaling pathways that are being modulated, regulated up or down by different probiotic strains. It's hard to talk about probiotics as a whole. This is the problem with the literature in terms of the meta-analysis and the big reviews, because if you lump it all together, you see the problem. It's very difficult then to really distinguish the signal from noise when you lump things together. So moving on, these organisms, the probiotics and beneficial microbes, can certainly enhance immunity. It's not just about suppressing immunity. And why is this important? Because in medicine, we want to figure out, can we boost vaccine efficacy? Can we defend against infection? Can we promote development of the immune system? So Jeff Priedus, another MD PhD student in the laboratory, has been highly motivated to pursue this issue. He's very concerned about global health and diarrheal disease burden in the world, the developing world particularly. There was a prior study showing that a probiotic could reduce duration of disease. There have been a number of other studies in different probiotics that have also demonstrated an effect on gastroenteritis diarrheal disease, either due to viruses or other causes. Jeff has developed a species-specific probe, so now you can see the intestinal bacteria, in this case Lactobacillus reuteri, that he administers to a neonatal mouse just at a few days of life. You can see them coating that villus here in the distal small intestine. These are DAPI-stained nuclei, and you can see without the organism, you just don't see these. Again, these are neonatal mice, very simple microbial community. They're just beginning to develop a microbiome, if you will. So this interaction is certainly of interest, and we think these organisms now are having a profound effect on that intestinal epithelium. The cytoplasm there is separating the nuclei from the bacteria. And now Jeff has been taking rotavirus in an infection model. Again, this paper is about to be submitted, will be submitted this summer. But he's inoculated the mice with rotavirus just a few days of life. He's become a master at doing this auric gastric lavage, and mice that literally fit right in the palm of the hand and can do that very well, hundreds of mice at a time without puncturing a single animal. So I defer to Jeff. He's the mouse gastroenterologist here. And he not only characterizes disease, we show a duration of this decrease in duration of disease in the animal, not a prevention of disease, but we do see a decrease in disease duration. The probiotic is administered 3 days before, then the animal is challenged with rotavirus, then we follow diarrhea. He also collects tissue then for analysis. And what Jeff has documented by looking at antibody is in the uninfected mouse, we don't see a boost in antibody production, but in the mice that then get challenged with a pathogen, in this case rotavirus, we see a significant increase in mucosal antibody production that's specific to the rotavirus. So somehow the administration of that probiotic very early in life primes that immune system so that it's ready when it gets challenged by an infectious agent. So we think this may be very important in terms of preventive medicine, whether we're talking veterinary medicine or human medicine. And we know this virus-specific antibody may be very important in terms of virus clearance, and this may be one reason why the animals do better with the probiotic strain. Now, what Jeff has also done is taken this further to look at intestinal physiology, and they neatly shown jelly roll technique here, which is a way of just looking at the whole intestine through the small intestine and large intestine. In animals now, they get a BRDU injection. They're not infected with rotavirus. They see the probiotic. They get a BRDU injection intraperitoneally. And now with BRDU staining, look at the brown nuclei here. You see many more. The more intensive staining, you can see it graphically here. We see enhanced proliferation here in the distal small intestine. These are basically the epithelial cells that are just beginning to develop from the stem cell. And they'll be migrating up the crypt, and we see enhanced development early on in the animal when they see this one bacterial strain. They're not germ-free mice. These mice are going to be exposed to their environment, but we are basically boosting their microbial signaling we're adding something, and similar to what might be happening with breast milk and with fortified formula too. Now, what we also are seeing is more rapid migration of these cells. It's not just proliferation. We follow this 2 days post-inoculation with BRDU as the stain. We see a more rapid migration up the villus here compared to animals that don't see the lactobacillus. And he shows us graphically here is migration from the cryptophilus boundary. And he's also now followed this, and we think what's going on is that these cells that are infected with rotavirus in the infected animal are sloughing off the infected cells more readily, and they're better able to withstand infection. And in the normal, uninfected animal, they're developing more rapidly. And we're hoping that this will have some real applications in human medicine with preterm infants, and being able to then take a preterm baby who needs a lot of help when they're outside mama's womb to get them going in terms of intestinal development. So, to summarize now, I just want to again, focus your attention on the microbes as a group. Obviously, this is a very crude depiction of the microbiome. Many different organisms here that are producing various factors. We're calling some of these immunomodulins. We have a variety of candidates, and it's been a very, very challenging quest in the past several years. But we do have some leads. In addition to short-chain fatty acids that are an important fuel source for epithelial cells, there are a variety of other molecules, fatty acids, and peptides that provide signals to these epithelial cells to then produce APRIL and BAFF, signals that allow lymphocytes to produce antibody, IgA, that may be specific for pathogen. They may also then stimulate macrophages and dendritic cells to signal and produce particular cytokines that then either enhance immunity or suppress immunity. And I'll just mention again the work from Denise Kelly and Dan Littman in the past 2 years showing that one particular bacterium in the mouse was responsible for differentiation of Th17 cells and production of IL-17. Really amazing science from other groups really shedding light on this. And these are organisms that we're just beginning to discover. Of course, in the area of probiotics, we've been familiar with a number of these organisms for a long period of time, but we're now finally beginning to understand molecular mechanisms of action and how the balance in that microbiome may affect immunity. We're also now getting interested in the enteric nervous system and behavior. And that expression gut feeling we really think is more than just an expression, but we think there's a real connection that we're just beginning to explore with respect to the nervous system. And really in closing, to address some of the discussion too after the after Dr. Kleinhammer's lecture, we see the future as evolving in two different directions. One is human and veterinary medicine, and developing robust applications to treat or prevent certain diseases. And this is really more oriented around treatment, although one could consider certainly specific prevention strategies to develop genetically modified organisms and designer strains. But we're also equally enthusiastic about just comparing strains and understanding them at the molecular level so that we can rationally select natural strains without engineering them and get to real combinations with different food matrices that make sense to deliver functional foods that are even more highly effective. I want to thank all of our collaborators in different institutions and, of course, our funding agencies and the National Institutes of Health and others that have really helped us to continue this effort. And not only are we different because of our own genes, but certainly our microbiomes have much to do with our variety. Thank you. Yeah, so that's a tough one. The balance word is a tricky one, I admit. When we talk about microbial balance, what do we really mean? We know that there are now certain predominant phyla, and this will differ depending on animal species, too. We're just beginning to get into that. And clearly we have to, I think, have some of the major groupings. There seems to be a need to have at the phylum level some basic consistency. And so restoring that may be very important. And when we add certain probiotics, we want to make sure that we're not destabilizing that microbiome too much. The problem is we don't know much in terms of the greater details. I mean, we do know in terms of antibiotic-associated diarrhea, colitis in humans now, that the humans that are susceptible to recurrent disease are affected much more greatly by antibiotics. And their microbiomes are much less diverse, restricted diversity that makes them very susceptible to Clostridium difficile and other Clostridium. So that's certainly a key point, and that species richness diversity appears to be quite important. So to the extent that a probiotic can promote that diversity, maybe it's a better word than balance and richness, and makes that population more resilient, that really is probably what we're aiming for, as long as we keep that basic composition intact. Yeah, so they do appear to be very small factors, although there have been examples of proteins pointing out Brent Folk's work with LGG. In our work, the factors that are responsible for anti-inflammatory effects all appear to be less than 3 kD, very small. I think that they are getting through this barrier, and I guess I have a more fluid, you know, the barrier is relative. I think there's enough porosity there where these small molecules can get through between epithelial cells. Some of them may be absorbed by epithelial cells. And certainly we know dendritic cells may be on the surface. Neutrophils appear to be, you know, in that mucus layer, so there may be direct interactions with neutrophils. So we think that's what's happened. But the chemical nature of these compounds is really tough. Yes. Yes, I definitely do. This has been a real challenge in the area of neonatology and human medicine, and I'm not well versed with veterinary medicine in this area, but it's a problem because so many of these neonates that are being born in neonatal ICUs are being kept for a period of time, and they really get hit hard with antibiotics to prevent the serious life-threatening infections that we're very well aware of. But we know that probiotics now can have a real impact in the area of necrotizing enterocolitis, or NEC as it's commonly referred to. And so we're beginning to see a shift in thinking in that area. I hope that moves along. One area in which we've seen a definite impact in our own hospital has been the aggressive use of donor milk, because until about 5 years ago, it was either baby gets mom's breast milk or formula. Well, because we have a large breast milk and they've been really a terrific team, we have had access to a lot of donor milk that our patients can then get, and they've been very receptive to that. Now, the simple point has been, hey, do you want to get formula and you don't know where that's come from, or do you want donor human milk and you know it's being basically banked here, et cetera? So that's had an impact, and we think that that's really dropped down the incidence of necrotizing enterocolitis, partly due to the beneficial bacteria, maybe the bifidobacteria in the breast milk, in addition to the other components in milk, which we'll hear about, I guess, in the next lecture.